belong to that.
Thank you, Chairman Bell. Today we have three action items and two information items on our agenda. We do have all four members of our committee here and present, and once again, we will need to start out with a motion and a second for each one of the action items so that we can discuss. Welcome. I'm glad that you're here as well. So the first item on the agenda, and Provost Lee, Dr. Lee, is going to assist us in some of the presentations. So if we could have a motion for the approval of the graduate certificate in scientific data. So you have a motion and a second. And with that, we'll open the floor for discussion. First, Dr. Lee, I think you'd like to make some comments.
Yes, we would. Thank you very much for reaching for that. We've come to you a couple of times in recent years with certificates, undergraduate and graduate level certificates. You may or may not be familiar with the concept of certificates. It's a bit of a new thing in higher education. It's been around for a while, but it gets more and more emphasis. It's a way of letting us give a student a specific credential, a specific expertise in a unique area that maybe sets them apart from everybody else in a job pool or prepares them a little bit better for some professional or graduate school experience. This one in particular deals with data management of large data sets, and the chief architect of this is Lance Hong, who is a faculty member in the Department of Psychological Sciences, and I'd like to ask Lance to introduce this to you.
Hello. Thanks for the time. Basically, technology has been driving the world towards more data. And we're seeing the need to be able to handle data sets that are large across the sciences. And students are already doing this in their classes and some of their coursework, and we just want to sort of be able to acknowledge that and give the certificate as a way of saying the student has done things with big data sets through their education, and they're well set to handle a big data set out in the world. It's also sort of provides a nice pathway so that if a student is coming to us already interested in big data, then they can see, okay, if they're in psychological sciences, for instance, they can take some coursework and get a certificate that better enables them to do those kinds of tasks. A few different motivations for this, and I'll try to keep it short, but in my own lab, I had a student working for me in graduate school as a graduate student, and he went on to, although he did some psychological studies, he's now in institutional research here working with big data. So often in a field, people will get trained on big data. They may focus on a specific topic or a field idea, like psychology, but it really prepares them for big data as well. I could talk a while. I'll just take questions and answer any questions I can.
This is a particularly timely certificate, and I certainly recommend it for your approval.
Comments? Yes, George?
This is exciting. I can't wait to get students so I can recruit them. I mean, this is the biggest thing going on in technology in corporate America. Every one of us is trying to find data scientists, people who are comfortable with dealing with this, so this is exciting. And I fully support it. The only question that I struggled with is when I looked at the list of other universities that are offering such programs, I was just surprised that sort of the area that we're introducing this from, as opposed to the business side or computers, that was the only thing that threw me off. I'm just glad we're doing it, so I don't want to find that. But, you know, when I think about, you know, when we look at recruiting people today at New York Life, you know, we're looking at probably folks coming out of the computer science departments. We're looking at people coming out of business analytics and obviously data mining. And I just was curious, do we feel like that the certificate of what we're teaching the kids at that level is transferable? And I recognize they may have to do more. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's, but is it something that can easily be transferable for them to do more if they want to get a degree in that versus just a certificate or something that they can apply to the broader sense of job opportunities in terms of when they go out?
Yeah,
Lance, could you speak to the flexibility of this this certificate a little bit?
Sure. I mean, it is by design flexible to allow people across a bunch of different fields to say, hey, not only am I an expert in biology, but I also do big data. So, and I think, and there is a business, there's something offered in the business school as well for undergraduate, but not, I don't think, this is really sort of recognizing that across the science fields, we have more and more of the technology we're using to ask the questions and answer the questions involves big data, and we need to have students to do that. But it's sort of, like I said, by design, we want anybody who's in sciences to be able to take the certificate and say, yes, I can do this in my domain area.
And I guess as we go through it, then what we should be thinking about is how to partner with the other departments within the university. Because, again, just as technology and business is coming together greater than it's ever had, it used to be the technology people would say, I would have given you what you asked for if you knew how to explain it. And then the business people were saying, well, I told you, but you didn't understand it. But now they're actually partnering together. And so if we do this, I just think it's important that if they're prepared coming out, they've got to understand that you're not going to help me if you're just telling me what big data is and how you look at it. You have to tell me how I apply it to my business or whatever I'm doing and the outcomes that I'm trying to get. And that may, again, that's a partnership where other disciplines can come in and use that core skill set that you have. And I just want to make sure that we do that, because otherwise, when they come out, then someone's got to retrain them for that piece. And that's missing the point where we can really get some value.
And I think one of the values here is that, you're sort of talking about this, I think, that you can have somebody who knows how to write programs, and they don't know how to do it in biology or psychology or business. And so just by requiring the student to not only know how to do programming, but do it on this kind of topic, then they know how to apply that skill.
Correct.
And it may, it's hard to anticipate where they might get employment, but there may be some retraining going on, but at least the employer will know, yes, this person not only knows how to write code, but they know how to apply it in this particular area with this expertise.
Right. So again, if you just touch those, and again, given this a certificate, and I know you're not, it could be the number of hours, you're saying overexposure, but some exposure to that is very helpful when people go out in the employment space, because I think they'll be able to come up with speed a lot quicker. Right.
I think we're going to go to the committee. Well, if you don't mind, Klaus, could I have Dr. Katz speak? He had might shed some light on the discussion so far, and then you can ask your question as well.
Really, thank you. Just as a point of clarification, for the Gordon Ford College of Business, we have an undergraduate certificate in data analytics. Our faculty were given a American Hospital Directory data set, one of the largest data sets to look at as examples of applied learning for our students. The faculty are skilled to work with Watson Analytics, SPSS, and SAS with our students. So we welcome this graduate certificate as an opportunity at the graduate level. The certificate, undergraduate certificate we offer is available at any major on campus. So we're excited about that. Thank you for your comment.
Thank you,
I wanted to follow up on what George said, so I just talked to Lance. I'm going to make sure that the Maths Department and the CS Department actually takes a good look at this. And I think, for example, the thesis hours in those departments, if they have to do with big data, this should be added to the list of courses, and he's open to that.
Okay.
So we'll add some other things to it.
At the first meeting that I attended, and we went through the, I know that I just learned at that time that we already had committee discussions, but in that report that we listed of some of the courses that some of the departments were offering, there was just a lot in there on technology and all that. And the only thing that jumped out at me at that time, and I didn't say anything because I didn't know I was supposed to say anything at the first meeting. So this is my second meeting.
You're following.
I'm trying to make up for lost time. Okay, again, it's just there's a lot of things happening. And as you're going through this process of how you're going to manage resources and then identify and reward performance, we're really going to have to stop and take a look at, okay, if one group is doing this, can the rest of us leverage this? As opposed to you do it and I'll do my own as well, my specialty. And because that was the thing that jumped out at me. I started seeing technology and a little reference to analytics and innovation and things like that. It really makes me nervous that people are saying, because I'm trying to do it just in my space. And right now, if we're going to be able to help our kids be successful when they get out of school, they're going to have to be critical thinkers.
Every strategic planning committee meeting I've been to so far, we've talked about tearing down silos. So I think that's beginning to happen again. The culture is changing.
It's been a great discussion. Thank you, George. Katz. Any more comments? I'll call for the question then. If all those in favor will say yay.
Yay.
Nay on the vote against. Passes. The second item, action items, the approval of sabbatical leave request. Dr. Lee, I think you had a few comments about that as well.
Yes, 13 of these 15 sabbatical applications you have before you are applications for first sabbaticals. And I'd like to give you a kind of collective biography of those 13 first sabbatical applicants. They are all folks who have terminal degrees in their field. They were all folks who were hired through a national search process. They were folks who were here over a six-year probationary period in which they were reviewed by their colleagues and by their department head, their dean, and provost each year for not only performance but also for progress toward tenure. And they also have achieved tenure and promotion to the rank of associate, at least associate professor. And they've gone through that very rigorous promotion and tenure process as a consequence of that. All of these folks have an expectation in scholarship, research, creative activity. And for the most part, they have gotten to where they are now on the strength of scholarship that originated in their graduate work. It's their dissertation turned into a book. It's a research project that has built itself into a laboratory that they're now staffing here at the university. But to a large extent, it's the work they did as graduate students that made them attractive to us in the first place, and it has kind of sustained them through a successful promotion and tenure process. And we've now come to a point where we have awarded them tenure. They've accepted tenure. And we've kind of mutually promised each other a long-term commitment in that process. So how the sabbatical process fits now is that these folks are now ready for the next phase in their career. They're ready for the phase of their career that points them toward the middle years of their career, gets them ready for application, full professor. And these proposals are their next big thing professionally in terms of their scholarship and their creative work. These proposals have all been vetted in their departments and approved by their department heads. They've come through college sabbatical advisory committees. They've been reviewed by deans. I have also taken a look at them. So not only have we put a lot of care into bringing these folks to this stage in their career, we've also invested a lot of care in looking at the projects that they're coming forward with. So what the sabbatical does is to give these folks an opportunity to focus for an entire semester on that particular project. They're excused from instructional and service responsibilities, and they focus for that entire semester on that project. It's very crucial, we believe, in terms of professional development of faculty, moving them into the next phase in their career. It really is a kind of return on the investment that we're making in them as professionals, as the folks we want to have working with our students for many years to come. So that's kind of the broader context of these sabbatical applications and how they fit within the context of what we're trying to do in academic affairs.
With that informational background, may I ask for a motion to approve in a second, and then we'll open it for board discussion.
So moved.
Second. Any other comments? Anyone like to speak towards this topic? What do you think? Yes.
I have been a beneficiary of sabbaticals. I've had three in my career, and I consider this one of the highlights of being actually a faculty member. And one of the things, the benefits of such a sabbatical may show up maybe a couple of years after you actually take it, because it allows you to travel, allows you to make new acquaintances, it allows you to start new things, and some disciplines, things move slowly. So this may yield in a publication maybe several years down the road. But I think we should support them. This is a wonderful thing for faculty to do.
Thank you for the testimonial. It certainly is important to hear that from those that have taken that in the past. I do think it's important to know that even in the business world, Stephen Covey says that you need to sharpen the saw and focus on the future for many institutions. And certainly that this is an example that someone has proven themselves, have been vetted by the department, by the deans. The process has been complete, and once it comes to us, we should support this. And I think this supports our faculty. This is a great thing for the board. So, if there are no more discussions, entertain a vote. Yay for approval.
Yay.
Nay. Pass. Next item is the approval of Emeritus Appointment. Once again, a very important item in the life of our university. Dr. Lee, would you please address that?
We have one Emeritus Appointment to recommend to you today, and that's Dr. Stephen Hagblum. Steve has a doctorate in experimental psychology from Purdue University. He was at Arkansas State for a long time, but he's certainly best known here on our campus as the head of the Department of Psychology. Role that he filled for a long time on this campus. He also had a somewhat shorter stint as the interim director of the Office of Sponsored Programs. Steve was very important in some transitions in the Department of Psychology. He was an important architect of the Department of Psychological Sciences, which is now in Ogden College of Science and Engineering. But he's somebody whose academic expertise and administrative leadership built a real legacy on this campus, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to recommend to you all Steve Hagblum for a Emeriti appointment.
Do I hear a motion?
Second.
Second. Any discussion? There being none, all those in favor, yay.
Yay.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. I think it should be noted that we have spent the last three action items on some important things that are focusing directly on our faculty, and it shows through the value added cost analysis basis of we're offering fantastic faculty achieving their goals, and we have recognized advancement, those that have succeeded in their career, and then, of course, an honor at the end of the American status. So all of those things said, this focus is not only on academics, but it's personal individuals that have added to this university over time. And we can't just let this be just an agenda item. And if you see any of these individuals on the campus, I would suggest that we all say thank you to each of them.
Appreciate your support.
With that, we have some informational items, recruitment marketing plan that we've touched on, as well as retention initiatives. So thank you, Dr. Well, if I'll have some looks, thank you on the group. With that, I'm going to turn this portion of the program over to
you. Good morning, still morning. My name is Jay Slocks. I'm the director of domestic undergraduate recruitment and admission at WKU. And I'm joined by Stacy Biggs. Stacy is WKU's Chief Marketing Officer. And our offices are within different divisions at WKU, but there's been a substantial amount of collaboration through the years, especially this year. So a lot of the initiatives that we're going to talk about that we have already deployed or initiatives that we're developing and plan on launching for the spring semester really are the product of substantial brainstorming and collaboration financially, resource-wise, between our two offices. So that's why we're presenting together today. And we're going to be talking about student recruitment of those first-time, first-year students. This is not working. Did somebody check the batteries? Well, I'll go ahead and move on because I know...
essence, but
we really find ourselves in a very interesting time of student recruitment, particularly among that traditional age student. We find ourselves in a time of declining population among high school graduates. That doesn't mean the percentage of students graduating from high school is going down. That just means that there are fewer students graduating from our nation's high schools. As a matter of fact, by 2022, there is a 4% decline projected in our nation's high school graduates. So there are just fewer students to recruit to our colleges and universities in the first place. Couple that with increased competition among colleges and universities. Every year we see more and more public, private, for-profit, not-for-profit institutions popping up in this country, all competing for a dwindling population of those high school graduates. And nationally, for the last decade and a half, we have been in an era of declining yield. Now, when we talk about yield among it within the context of higher education, we're talking about those students who are admitted to an institution who actually end up enrolling at an institution. And you can see beginning there in 2001, this is a national trend that has plagued colleges and universities for quite some time. Declining number of students being admitted to institutions that are actually enrolling in those institutions. I think a lot of times it's easy to assume that the enrollment challenges that WKU faces are ours and ours alone. And that simply isn't the case. We are not alone. As a matter of fact, I listened to a webinar yesterday that indicated last fall, less than 40% of colleges and universities in America hit their enrollment goals. Some are facing far more substantial enrollment challenges than we are here on the Hill. When you look at WKU's yield, ours is the red number against our benchmark institutions, you can see that we, over a five-year period, have fared a little bit better than our benchmark institutions. The same holds true when you look at WKU against the other four-year publics in Kentucky. Our yield rate has trended a little bit better. And nationally, against other four-year public institutions across the nation, we still yield students a little bit higher than the national average. But we realize that our yield is a concern, and it's something that we really have to increase if we're going to help solve some of these enrollment challenges on the front end. So our office this year has made a very strategic decision to shift our focus to yielding those students that we do admit. WKU doesn't have a problem recruiting students. Students are very interested in applying here and enrolling here, and historically, we've been very interested as an institution in growing the top of our enrollment funnel. This is WKU's enrollment funnel. Every college and university has some version of an enrollment funnel that looks very similar to this one. And historically, we've been focused as an institution on let's identify more prospective students, let's get more students to submit inquiries so that we can grow that applicant and admit pool. And we've been very successful at that. Over the last 3 years alone, we've experienced over a 26% increase in the number of first-time, first-year students that we've admitted to WKU. But our yield of those students has not kept pace with the increase in the admitted students. So this year, we're really focusing on the bottom of the funnel. Those students that we admit, encouraging them to follow all the way through the process and actually enroll in classes at WKU. And that really is an institution-wide effort. Some of the things that we're doing in our office to help meet that goal.
Do you have a target? We want to get to it.
A target number for per fall? For yield?
That you want to get to.
I'd love to see a 3% increase in our yield. That's it's still early in the enrollment. So students haven't enrolled in fall classes yet, so we haven't yet been able to see how that trends. About all we have to go on right now are the number of admitted students, and we're trending about right where we were this time last year. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the changes that we've made in our student standards in a little bit. But,
really focused on more data-driven decisions in our recruitment. This past year, we hired a data analyst in the Office of Admissions to ensure that our recruitment decisions are not based solely on intuition or instinct, but rather on data. For example, when you look at the fact that we are projecting, not us, but there is a projected population decline among high school, the number of high school graduates in Kentucky, one would think, well, let's just turn to Illinois or Ohio, some of those neighboring states that historically have produced large numbers of students for WKU. But when you really take a deep dive into the data and see that Illinois is projected to experience about a 5% decline in its number of high school graduates, Ohio is expected to experience about a 6% decline, similar numbers for Indiana and Tennessee. And diving into that data has helped us to avoid some of those costly stumbles of spending a whole lot of unnecessary time or money in pockets that just don't represent opportunities for enrollment growth for us. We also are dedicated to cultivating new markets and have been very intentional about examining the data to determine where are some of those pockets around the country that do represent opportunities for enrollment growth at WKU. WKU spends about $505 per student that we recruit from the point of recruitment all the way through to enrollment. So that's our office spends about $505 per student. So we just can't afford to make costly stumbles when it comes to trying to open up new markets and identify new regions for growth. Obviously, we have increased our focus on parents. 77% of first-time, first-year students indicated that their parents are still a chief influencer in their college decision. So students may tell you, or parents may tell you, oh, I would like our student to go wherever they're happy, but I can guarantee you that the parents are helping them dwindle that list of prospective colleges down. So we've increased our communication directly with parents, email messages targeting specifically to parents, in some cases even text messaging targeting the parents of admitted or prospective students, direct mail pieces that are targeting parents of those students. Obviously, we remain committed to our existing markets and have done everything we can to increase our engagement in those markets, making sure that we're at least sustaining the number of visits to prospective students and their families in those markets, and in many cases, increasing where possible. And we've been very intentional about talking with guidance counselors in those markets, parents, and prospective students about the benefits of starting and finishing at a four-year institution. We also have ensured that there's a recruitment focus in all of our institutional messaging. I think historically WKU has done a very good job of general brand awareness, but we're ensuring that everything that gets pushed out of admissions and every message that gets pushed out of marketing and public affairs has recruitment as its focus. And we're engaging in specific calls to action with students and their families. Visit campus, register for orientation. The housing deadline is approaching. So that students aren't just receiving, hey, we're WKU, but we're WKU, and this is what we'd love for you to do with us. We also remain committed to surveying students to better understand their decision-making process. So every fall for the last 2 years, we have surveyed two groups of students, students that have been admitted to WKU and enrolled here, and students that were admitted to WKU and did not enroll here. And those findings have really helped us to refine some of our processes and ascertain what has worked and what didn't work. What did students like and what did they not like as they were going through the recruitment process with WKU? Yes.
Would you mind give us a couple of examples of why they don't come for the lay people out here that are not involved?
Well, the number one reason is money. That's an open-ended question on the survey. I didn't want to limit them to just a multiple choice of five different reasons that they didn't come. So, in many cases, we'll get lengthy paragraphs about, well, I wanted to come, but my boyfriend said he would break up with me if I did. But in I'd say 80% of those responses are all money related. And so we actually added a question on to the survey this year. If your chief reason for not coming to WKU is money related, what's the shortfall? Hoping that it would provide us with a pretty specific number that could be used in future scholarship decisions. But those answers were really all over the board. Some said as little as $500. Some of them said I would have needed a full ride for it to even be within the realm of possibility.
That's comparing with either our peer group or where they did attend.
Mm-hmm. And not everyone enrolled anywhere. There were about 12% of respondents who didn't enroll anywhere else. That they just chose not to go to college. So.
Can I ask a question? Do you have any data how actually the Constitution affects this funnel? So, for example, can you compare our rates of cost with somebody else's rates of cost of actually drug companies? How what the effect is?
I know there is an initiative among the scholarship committee to look at exactly that information and kind of where we're losing students. Where are they going, and maybe if we can access that information, how much were they getting from that institution that they didn't get from WKU to further refine that need-based scholarship that I know as an institution we're hoping we can move more toward a need-based rather than the almost exclusive merit-based system that we have now. That I don't know if Student Financial Assistance has that data or not, Cindy, for that,
it's similar to what you said on the responses. It's really all over the radar because we have our high-need students that, in some instances, their unmet need ends up being lower than a student who is maybe a student that is just above the eligibility for Pell Grant with their highest need, and about a third of our undergrad students are Pell Grant eligible. So they're getting federal aid and state aid that helps bridge the gap between that shortfall. What we find is the student, so really even digging down to the type of student to determine what that average shortfall is, but the student that doesn't qualify necessarily for our highest need-based grant but still demonstrates a gross unmet need, the cost of attendance of education minus their estimated family contribution. That's a group that number is even higher. And a lot of times those students are not getting federal grants, state grants, and as you know, student loans are limited with what that annual amount is. So when you take the cost of tuition and you take housing, meals, and books, which are those direct costs, and you take off just a freshman level student loan, there's a significant shortfall there. So those students either have to count on having a creditworthy parent that can apply for a parent loan, or if that parent is denied, we can get them a little more student loan. But certainly that is one thing that we're looking at. Somewhat of an opportunity scholarship that will look at those students that are not receiving any other resources and have that shortfall and maybe a way that we can help bridge that gap even further.
That's great information. Thank
you. Those admitted student surveys have been very helpful for a variety of reasons. I think my hope was that we would go, okay, it's $1,284. If we could come up with that for this population of students, we'd be able to get them here and assist them, but the range was so great. But I know that was a very long answer to a short question. That's the primary reason that students aren't coming here. Now we do, you know, also get those. It was too close to home or too far from home, and we're tailoring our messages to make that prospect of going to school in the county where you were born and raised a little less scary, or going to school in a county that's 3 hours away a little less scary for students. But those surveys have been very insightful for us.
Well, I think what you've described for us is that it is a moving target, and we all want to sit here today and say, well, if we only knew this is the answer, we would change it. But we can't, because it is a dynamic of human behavior. It's not just finances. It's the friend at home that they went to another university. It's I got all the way and I didn't have the grades. Whatever it is not one answer. So a department that must be broad-based in solving this problem is going to be better than saying here's the answer. It isn't. That's what your dad's telling you.
Right. And it has helped us to have those conversations with students and parents about this is an investment. it may seem like a costly expense right now, but it is an investment when you look at your total lifetime earnings. So all of that combined has really helped us to tailor our communications outbound from the university moving forward. And it is like Sharon said, with retention, it's certainly not a flat target. It's a
lot. Yes. And when you discuss parental involvement in the institutional messaging and then cultivating new markets, are you focusing specifically on a student's senior year of high school or even further, like earlier than that?
That is two slides away.
Okay.
but no, we're working ever harder to identify students earlier in their high school careers. It used to be 5 or 10 years ago that students, parents, and guidance counselors didn't want you bothering them until their senior year because, well, let me focus on the next 2 or 3 years of high school, and that's simply not the case anymore. And a lot of that, thanks for the setup, comes with this arrival of Generation Z that we find ourselves working with now. Just when we kind of all thought we had our heads around the millennials and had a little bit better understanding of them, this new generation bursts onto the scene, and that's who we're seeing in our freshman and sophomore class here at WKU now, certainly high school students and families with which we're working. Some refer to it as the homeland generation. But this really is a different animal with which we're working. This is a generation whose world is largely curated by what they see on social media. It's the on-demand generation. This is the generation that doesn't know what it's like to sit by the radio for 2 hours and wait for your favorite song to play again. If they want to hear their favorite song, they download it from iTunes and listen to it whenever they want on their phone. And so we're cognizant of that and understand that Generation Z is driving, and their behaviors are driving a lot of our communications moving forward and a lot of our behaviors as an institution moving forward. So now our communications, rather than one general message to every single student in our prospect, that's a prospect in our enrollment funnel, our communications are cued based on student interests, based on actions that the student may take within our institutional website, in a lot of cases even based on geographic origin. So depending on where you live in the country, you may receive a different set of messages than someone who lives in Bowling Green. They may receive a different set of messages than you. So we're able to filter down and drill down into a number of characteristics that our prospective students are exhibiting in order to tailor messages to them to meet their needs and their expectations. That they expect that on-demand behavior from the universities with which they're working. And we're constantly analyzing the performance of our communication. So every single email that we send out, we look at the open rates of those emails, what percentage of those emails were opened and read versus what percentage were just deleted before the student or parent ever even read them. If there's a link within the email that we'd like the student to click on to learn more information, what are the click-through rates of those messages? And we're also engaging in those personal touches that I know a lot of other colleges and universities just aren't doing. A great example of this is handwritten notes to admitted students from their admissions counselor. For the past 2 years, each of our 8 admissions counselors have randomly selected a group of 300 students that have been admitted to WKU from their recruitment territory and sent handwritten notes to them. So it's just a congratulations on joining the Hilltopper family. We're very excited to welcome you to campus. Please let us know if there are any questions we can help answer. What we noticed was that among those students who received those notes, we experienced a 3.1% increase in yield among those students versus students who didn't receive those handwritten notes. And this was a random sample. This was not sent to students above a certain GPA or below a certain GPA. This was a random sample of all admitted students. So guess what? Every single student who's admitted to Western Kentucky University this for the fall 18 semester will now receive a handwritten note from their admissions counselor in the hopes that it will help move the needle positively on our yield. And we also continue to refine and tweak and continuously evaluating the implementation plan. That's a very much a living, breathing document that is never quote unquote done. Recruitment begins early. We are working as hard as possible, specifically within Kentucky, to identify students at the sophomore level. So many of the current seniors in Kentucky high schools have now been recruited by WKU since they were a sophomore in high school, if we were able to identify that student at that stage. And for those students that have been recruited since their sophomore year, who are now seniors, they received a minimum of 110 touch points from WKU. This could be phone calls from our office, this could be text messages, emails, direct mail pieces, invitations to recruitment events that we host on campus and off. But that recruitment does begin early for those students because that's what they want now. This is also a generation that's used to shopping and comparison. And as gross an oversimplification as that may be, that's what students are doing with us. They are, quote unquote, shopping for colleges now. And so we're working with them to make them understand that it's a whole lot more than just a cost comparison. And the earlier we can reach students, the better we can explain that message. You'll also notice a very intentional language shift institutionally, particularly in the messages that are going out to students. Historically at WKU, we've done a very good job of talking about ourselves. We've invested nearly $1 billion in campus upgrades. We are the home of the Gatton Academy. We are one of a handful of Chinese language flagship programs in the country. And those are things of which we should be extremely proud. But this generation, they don't want to talk about you. They want to talk about themselves. So there's been a very intentional shift out of our office and out of public affairs to ensure that our language is more along the lines of you desire to be the architect of your higher education experience. Let WKU help you reach that goal. And that's quite a departure from the way we have communicated with students, not just in admissions, but as an institution historically. And we also have done a very good job historically as an institution of communicating practical or logical reasons why a student should choose WKU. But I don't know that we have fully capitalized on the unique emotional appeal of this place. And so the communications that we're pushing out to prospective students and their families, as well as admitted students and their families, have been very intentional about trying to work the emotional appeal of this place in here. This generation wants to be part of something bigger and part of something of which they can be proud. So we're trying to make them early on feel a part of that. And I think you'll, at the end of our presentation, really kind of see that in action. So I'm going to turn it over to Stacy. She's going to talk a little bit more specifically about some of our design shifts.
So with all of those things in mind, talking about you, we have worked together to come up with some new design strategies and parameters to hopefully punch up the effectiveness of the pieces that we're sending out, all of the recruiting pieces, and there are a lot of them. We are using a bit of a minimalist approach both in our design and in our messaging. And everything that we send, everything, has a very specific time, a very specific purpose, and message. So previous design strategy, this is a postcard that was sent out last year. This one is about housing and lovely pictures of campus and things going on here. What I think you'll notice is that on the back of the postcard where it says we're excited for you, there's a lot of text right there. And what our studies are showing us is that they just won't tolerate that much text. They won't read it. So that's part of the reason we've decided to simplify things just a little bit. So while this is very attractive, there's a little too much going on here. So by contrast, I think this is one of our new pieces. And I think what you'll notice first is simplification that we have done on here. So the front, there is one message. In this particular case, the call to action is make the hill your home. This one is specifically about housing on campus. So we've simplified the design, and on the back, maximum of 2 to 3 sentences of text. This is all we're using, and that's across the board on all of our postcard mailings.
We've also incorporated Big Red because everybody loves Big Red and very eye-catching and that kind of thing. So we've made some major shifts in the design that flow throughout all of the pieces that we are sending. Direct mail has increased dramatically, the amount that we're sending. In fact, this year we're sending nearly 30 postcards. Not every prospective student will get every postcard because the messages are very targeted to various populations, whereas last year we sent out about 10 postcards, so dramatic increase in the number there. The postcards obviously are meant to go to students in most cases, but they also reach the parents because the parents see the mail. They're the ones who see what's laying on the kitchen counter. And the kitchen counter concept is kind of what we're going for here. And what we mean by that is that a piece that is well designed and has a relevant message and that's properly timed hopefully will lay on that kitchen counter long enough to become an actionable piece and to become a distinction point for the student and their parent. So we want them to see WKU in their collection of college materials more than they see any other school that is also trying to recruit them. And another reason for the dramatic increase in the amount of mail that we're sending out is because our studies, the surveys that Jace was just talking about, are showing us that they are effective and students are remembering them, they're noticing them, and they can actually recall getting those pieces in the mail. In fact, 61% of those who responded to the survey told us that they got many more pieces from WKU than they got from other places, and another 28% said they got at least as many from WKU.
Was that a good or bad thing?
That's a good thing. That's a good thing. Because
I'm thinking of this. I used to run the direct marketing for AARP, and people hated getting AARP. Mm-hmm. I'm sure for a lot of
reasons.
But I was just curious is that they remember it, but I wondered if they say, have you ever just said me too much?
We actually, and that's one of the questions, was it too much? Was it just enough? Was it not enough?
Good.
That's one of the questions on there. And I think almost across the board, it was about right or maybe.
Oh, good.
So, again, I think that they're remembering it. And that's, so what we want to do then is make them. That's kind of our goal with this. So, also, I want to point out, it's not just postcards that they're receiving. They're also getting letters from Jace. They're getting letters from the credit cards. They're getting the handwritten notes that we talked about before. And also, it's a follow-up handwritten note from their tour guide. And a lot of those have told us that that was really kind of a cool touch. So, definitely continuing that. Email is also an important part of our overall communication strategy, and we have invested in an automation system called a Customer Relationship Management System, or CRM, that lets us customize, personalize, and automate the messages that go out to students. So we're able to create campaigns that are email-based, the direct mail pieces, all of the communications that we have can be logged and tracked through the CRM. Email itself is incredibly important, and in fact, as you can see on the screen, in 2017, from July 1 to December 31st, we sent out more than 1.2 million emails to parents and to their students. So again, as Jay said, we're watching the open rates, we're watching the click-through rates, all of those things to see what's effective. We're adjusting messages as needed. We have changed the design guidelines on the emails, just like we have on the postcards, to try to make sure that our message is as effective as possible. Digital advertisements are also very important. So if you've ever shopped online, we just had Christmas, so lots of you probably shopped online, and you were shopping for a specific pair of shoes or your summer vacation destination, and you finish your shopping, you bought or you didn't buy, and you navigate away to, say, Facebook or some other website, and suddenly, lo and behold, you see an advertisement for that exact same pair of shoes that you were just shopping for, or that exact vacation destination that you were looking at. That's a digital strategy called retargeting. Very effective. We use that as we're trying to reach prospective students as well. So if they come to the WKU website once or twice, then they navigate away to somewhere else, perhaps Facebook or any number of websites, they will suddenly begin to see WKU targeted ads popping up on their screen. So that's always trying to stay top of mind. Now, those targeted ads can also be specific with messaging based on what they have expressed interest in, either for email or website or what have you. So those are very targeted and very specific to students who are in our funnel. And of course, social media is incredibly important. Purchase ads on Facebook, we boost posts on Facebook and those kinds of things. And we use social media to push out specific timelines and deadlines and things like that. So for example, we have the scholarship deadline that's coming up on February 1st. And so right now, you'll see messages being pushed out on social media about that, as well as emails and various other things. But I think what's most important with social media is the one-on-one engagement that it allows us to have with students. This is an example of some of the pictures that you see here in this collage. Students are excited when they get that acceptance letter and their poster that says they're in class of 2022, and we encourage them to share that excitement on social media. And that helps us to reach out to them as another touch point to share in that excitement with them. So here's a specific example of that. This one happened just a few weeks ago. Congratulations, we're so happy you're officially a Hilltopper. That sort of thing happens every single day because we'd like to share in that excitement with them. It gives them more visibility and us more visibility as well. And of course, the website is often one of the first touch points that we have with students because they, as they begin their shopping experience for college, they come to the website to look for information. So in 2017, the admissions website underwent a pretty major overhaul that mimics the WKU.edu homepage. The new design is very intentional, focused on the visitor and the needs of prospective students and the things that we know they look for. So we can track using analytics what are the most important topics to students based on where they visit on our website and how much time they spend on various pages and those kinds of things. So the new website design also let us add some additional functionalities, one of which you see right here in the bottom left. This is it's called a toaster ad because it pops up for certain students based on where they are in the funnel. This one is geared specifically towards students who would qualify for the tuition incentive program if they live in a TIP area.
We also do that with the digital retargeting. So if you see where they've gone on the website, it's targeting that. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. If we see that they've spent, for TIP is a good example of that. Right. If we see that they've spent a great deal of time looking for information on TIP and they happen to live in one of our TIP counties where they would qualify for that incentive program, they might get a TIP ad on retargeting.
And similarly to that, so if you see that they have like a specific, I don't know, like problem area, you're referencing money was a big issue or it was away from home, have you also found ways to target those issues, I guess, based on county or conversations that you have? Or?
A lot of that is based on our messaging about getting involved in campus.
Okay.
And offering them information about all the different things that are available here and how they can be involved, how they can. Even messages as specific as how to make friends, read more information, any number of things that, because we know when they get to campus and become involved in campus, they have a much better retention rate. So a lot of that's based on the messaging.
So
I showed you the toaster ad that popped up. They also have a very easy way to, if they have not been contacted by us yet, they can tell us a little bit about themselves by filling out a form on the website, and then they will get worked into our communication funnel so that they'll begin to get all the pieces that are coming up in the next cycle of communications. And, of course, we want to make it as easy as possible for them to communicate with us by phone, whether it's landline or cell phone. One of the things that we've done is made some major tweaks to the admissions phone system to greatly reduce or even eliminate wait time if they call the admissions office and want some information. So there are more people who are trained and more people available all the time to answer the phone, so hopefully they don't have to wait. Texting, of course, is incredibly important to this generation. One of the studies that we looked at, we were shocked to see these numbers, showed us that 98% of text messages delivered to a 17 or 18-year-old student are read within 1 minute. 98%. So, of course, we're texting them. They have to opt in to be texted, but luckily for us, 87% of those who apply and they opt in during the application process, 87% have consented to converse with us by text message. And I just wanted you to see a quick sample of that. So I don't expect you to be able to read all of the small text on here, but this is screenshots of an actual conversation between an admissions counselor and a prospective student, where the admissions counselor initiated the conversation, but then went back and forth because they had some specific questions, and they were able to get that one-on-one attention, get their questions answered on the spot, and that instant gratification. And they ended the conversation by the student saying, OMG, thank you so much. That's how they communicate, and so we want to make that as easy for them as possible.
And you know, we've spent quite a bit of time talking about the technological strategies, the digital strategies that we have deployed and are currently deploying this year. But I certainly don't want you to think that we have just completely relied on that and removed that crucial element of face-to-face interactions with the students. Our office continues to remain very engaged on a one-to-one basis with students and their families. This is for fall of 2017 alone. We made nearly 500 high school event visits, participated in 227 college fairs, and generated over 23,000 unique inquiries among students as a result of those events just last semester alone. We visited 16 states, and we're ensuring that our travel is data-driven. So let me give you a really good example of that. Historically, WKU has done a good job of with students in the Chicago area. And so our approach historically was, well, let's have a representative go to Chicago a couple times a year and just hit as many high schools as possible while they're there. Well, this past summer, we took a pretty deep dive into the data, and what we realized was, yes, we've done very well in the Chicago area, but it's all been from several very specific zip codes within the Chicago area. And some of these other zip codes where we may have spent hours and hours of our time and spent a lot of money hosting events just hadn't over the past 5 or 10 years produced students for us. So this year when we've gone to Chicago a couple of times, we've been very intentional about cultivating those markets that have historically produced for us and not spending as much of our resources in those markets that no matter what we do, it just doesn't seem to move the needle. So that's been a big change that we've experienced by taking a deeper dive into the data and letting it influence our travel. We also continue to host a number of recruitment events both on campus and off. In the fall 2017 alone, fall 2017 semester alone, nearly 8,000 visitors took an official campus tour through the WKU Office of Admissions. We offer multiple tours every weekday and on many Fridays, and so nearly 8,000 visitors took advantage of that. We remain committed to hosting large on-campus recruitment events. One of the most notable is Head for the Hill, which is basically a very large open house that we host several times throughout the year on campus where we really roll out the red carpet for prospective students and their families. Last fall, over 3,100 guests came to campus as a result of those Head for the Hill events. We talked about the handwritten notes. Every one of those 3,100 guests has got a handwritten thank you for attending note for me in the fall. We continue to host events in regions. Discover WKU is eventually where we will is where we will send representatives from the WKU Office of Admissions to various communities to host information nights for prospective students and their families. We hosted over 20 of those in the fall. Many of them were in Kentucky, but we also hosted events in Indiana, Tennessee, Illinois, Ohio, North Carolina, Florida, Texas, California, areas that either had tip counties or just represented opportunities for growth for us. So we continue to host those and analyze their performance. Did you have a slide?
No, I apologize. So what is your specific relationship with Warren County Recruitment? Because I know that you previously referenced a lot of students perceive that it's too close, and so they automatically mark it off. So what are some specific things that you do, I guess, within schools in just this county specifically?
Well, we have 8 admissions counselors, and one of those admissions counselors is responsible for just Bowling Green and Warren County.
Okay.
So she is able to, while most of our admissions counselors may have 200 or 300 schools for which they're responsible, Laura is responsible only for the schools in Bowling Green and Warren County, so that she can be there immediately if she needs to. She can meet with local families at Panera if they have questions. You know, we're trying to give as much of that personal, immediate availability to Warren County as possible. You know, the senior class at South Warren, I'd say about About a quarter of South Warren's senior class has already been admitted to WK. So we continue to try to work on those relationships with our local schools. I talked about communications that were specific to students based on their geographic origin. We have a handful of communications that we sent in the fall to students specifically from Bowling Green that said, you may think of us as just being in your backyard, but go away to school at WKU.
Right.
And as much as possible, we work with on having current students from the Bowling Green and Warren County area have face-to-face interactions so they can talk to students about, I was hesitant to come here because it was too close to home. I didn't want to take classes with everyone that I was in high school with. But when I got to WKU, that was not my experience at all. And as a matter of fact, my parents kind of get on my case because I don't come home enough.
Right.
So we're doing as much as possible to make sure students understand that they may have grown up here coming to basketball games or band competitions or whatever the case might be, but there's a lot more to WKU if you look at it through the eyes of a prospective student.
Right. And do you encourage, because I know I'm from Louisville and I was heavily recruited by U of L in a similar manner, do you encourage students to have like an overnight here? Is that feasible? Because I know that's what U of L did to sort of, I guess, get us into campus instead of just on campus.
We don't currently. Now, a number of our local students will end up having an overnight experience because they'll come here for a camp over the summer,
right,
or for a, you know, for a weekend event. Our residence hall structure is such that,
right,
there aren't a lot of additional beds to do those kind of opportunities. I know in the past, for certain student groups, the Honors College, for example, mm-hmm, athletics, for example, have provided opportunities for to pair prospective students up with current students, mm-hmm, and that may be student athletes or may be in the Honors College. On a wide scale, just given the number of prospective students in the funnel, being able to have them on campus overnight is a bit of just a challenge for Noah. What we have done with our local students is tried to, even though it may not be an overnight experience, we've really tried to engage them in what we call day on campus. And it's not just for Warren County. We have a number of schools from Davies County and Owensboro, for example, some from Jefferson County.
Right.
But we provide day on campus experiences for some schools will bring their entire senior class. And so students will have the opportunity to attend information sessions, talk with representatives from different departments, in some cases sit in on classes, meet with current students and majors that they may have an interest in. So we try to provide that kind of on-campus experience to students.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We got time for one more question. And go ahead.
Okay, so follow-up question. We have sort of a service area to WQ assigned by the legislature, and if you look at the eligible high school population there, we always have sort of, we attract a certain percentage. How has that percentage shifted over the last couple of years?
Since I've been in admissions, it's remained fairly constant.
Can you ballpark it?
Not off the top of my head.
No, I can't.
I know we can find it. I know, for example, just looking at applications for the fall of 2018 semester, looking at, you know, Barron County and Glasgow, we've seen a substantial shift upwards in the number of students from that area that have applied to WKU. So now the challenge is yielding those students. But I would say on the whole, over a 5 or 10 year period, it's remained fairly constant through our service area beyond just Warren County. I can work with IR to find that information for you.
Thank you.
Okay. And
for the time, we're encroaching into another. We got another one after you guys. So if we can.
And we, as an office, remain committed to that student success. And Regent Nichols, you brought this up earlier, and I'm glad that you did. It's a good springboard for this conversation. You know, Dr. Caboni, in his opening convocation in August, for which many of you were present, talked about WKU's commitment to evaluating our admission standards to make sure that we're not unnecessarily saddling students who the data shows probably are not quite ready for success here at WKU with a lot of unnecessary things. It's just not the right thing to do. How did you put it? Access without success is access to nothing. In the fall semester with Dr. Cavone's leadership and guidance, we did reevaluate and make some tweaks to our admission standards both for incoming students and for transfer students. And that has resulted in us denying more students for admission at this time this year than we had at this time last year. But the data was showing that they were not succeeding at fairly alarming rates. And so doing so comes with a risk. It could mean a smaller incoming class, but hopefully it also means an incoming class who is better prepared to stay here and succeed here and ultimately graduate with a WKU degree rather than come here for a semester or two or three, rack up debt, and then leave with nothing to show for it. So we do, in the face of our recruitment and yield efforts, do remain committed to student success throughout. And finally, I've talked about some of the collaboration between admissions and public affairs. We worked very closely with Anthony McAdoo and the Alumni Association on developing a network of alumni who have volunteered to host to help with college fair coverage when additional help is needed, to write notes to admitted students in their local areas, to help with various recruitment events, to help with scholarship presentation at high school award ceremonies this spring. Some of them have agreed to host senior send-off parties to admitted students in their areas this summer. And we've also collaborated with parking and transportation. One of the things that has regularly kept me up at night is the state of our admissions tour bus. There are parts of it that are literally held together by duct tape. And that's not a good first impression to make to prospective students and their families. But I also realize that within the admissions budget, we don't have an extra six figures laying around to buy a new tour bus. And parking and transportation realize that need for us. They also have realized that they had a vehicle that was relatively underutilized. And so Brad Wheeler and Jennifer Tugas reached out and offered to transfer ownership of that to us at no cost so that we can use that money to further recruit students. So that's just some very quick examples of collaboration. Probably the most visible collaborative effort that we have engaged in public affairs has been a commercial that you all have probably seen. It began airing in late December, but it's the start of our Climb With Us campaign, and that truly is the most visible example of collaboration between our two units. So, Stacy, turn it over to you real quick, and we'll, it's 30 seconds. 30
seconds.
Yeah,
thank you. 30 seconds, student talent. I think you'll hopefully like what you see. This is the first of several commercials, so we wanted to share that with you guys today.
Life path is easy, or the inspired. There is a spirit that kindles a desire to climb higher, to soar, to hope, to reach new heights. The wish to be a part of something more, to do more and to be more. Hilltoppers know that life at the top is worth the climb. Climb with us at Western Kentucky University.
So I think you see hopefully some more of that emotional appeal and being part of something bigger. And I just wanted to acknowledge that silky smooth voice that you heard narrating there. This is DeJuan Green. DeJuan is a senior from Texas at WKU, and he is the voice talent in that commercial. So I just wanted to, it's always nice to put a face with a voice whenever if you've seen that a couple of times. So he's a member of our national championship forensics team. Is going to go on and do big things after his time at WKU, I have no doubt.
Would you please stand? Yes. And thank you very much. We've done a lot of administrative work today, a lot of academics right now, but that's the reason we're here in our student region. It's all about you guys and educating and training. Thank you for doing what you do. You really did. Mr. Chairman, we're running a little long. I'm going to leave it to you to make a suggestion if you have any or you want to progress with our last information item. It's up to you.
we're going to have a working lunch. We're going to grab a plate and eat. But Brian, how long is your presentation?
Pretty brief. I don't know how we're going to control for questions.
Yeah. We're trying to assimilate a lot of information here, good information, great stuff on recruitment. We could even have you come back at the next meeting and expound if you need to, but why don't you take just a few minutes and preview for us, and then if we
go long, you stop us.
We can.
I'll do it. I'll be the get bad guy.
And then we'll grab a plate and move into student affairs.
And with that, we have the retention initiatives. Thank you, Tim, and Dr. Meredith as well.
Just very quickly to get us started, and I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Jensen. When you're talking about retention and student success, continuing on that theme today of many of the many presentations we've had, there's no one silver bullet. I know that's cliche-ish, but it's very true. It's more of a smattering or a peppering when it comes to retention and student success of multiple programs, initiatives, and crisscross divisions. And really, enrollment management ends up being kind of the go-between, the bridge between academic affairs and student affairs to help make sure all of that pulls off accordingly. What you're going to see and what Chris is going to talk with you about in no way is exhaustive of all the initiatives going on with retention and student success, but it'll give you a kind of a flavor, a taste, if you will. And I'm going to be quiet and let Chris, who is our director of the Academic Advising and Retention Center, as well as he directs our transfer center, is one of the many leaders that works very closely with our retention initiatives. Chris?
Thanks. Thank you for the time today. I will try to be Beth. I'm from the North originally, so I'll probably talk through this really quick. So if I'm talking too fast, just slow me down.
Well, and again, I don't rule out the possibility of having you come back. It is a lot of information being thrown out today. And sure. Retention is very important. It's as important as recruitment. And so we do want to have the board well informed about it. And again, maybe we can get an overview today and have you on the agenda. I know you all are at every meeting we have.
So we're going to start by just saying where we are currently, giving facts about retention and the statistics. What we're doing as an institution, a lot of it is specific to the office I work in, and then our future plans moving forward. As you can see here, this is kind of our retention numbers from 2012 through 2015. We were usually in the low 70% from first year to second year for full-time baccalaureate degree-seeking students. And then in the fall of 2016, we did dip below 70% to 69.9. One thing that is interesting here that I just see, but I don't know if there's anything with it. If you notice, we always seem to be around 2,000 students, just kind of seems to be that mark of where we are of continuing students first to second year. Here it is by the numbers. This is first-time, full-time students by residency. Just trying to see total numbers. The number is larger because of associate degree-seeking students being in here. So this is all students that are at the university for their first year that are going full-time. Obviously, the majority of our students are within the state. Then we have the TIP, reciprocity out-of-state, and international. What's really most important is probably seeing how we break down semester by semester. This is preliminary data for spring in the right-hand column. We're going to go through and it'll show some breakdowns of specific population. So at the current time from fall to spring, we're at about 85.3%. This data was pulled early in the week, so that has probably gone up. Our advisors have been busy trying to get students registered for the spring semester, so that does put us a little bit ahead of where we were last year. For all students, we're running at about 82.5. Underrepresented minorities, you'll see that 71. Not underrepresented minorities is 85.6. We broke that data down a little more, so this does show we have some work in some areas. With our African-American students, we're at 68%, Hispanics 77.5%, and then you'll see our females are at a little higher rate than our males. Most of our students within the state are retained at a little bit higher rate. You have the other information there. It should be noted that out-of-state domestic, you do see a large drop-off. That's just because the number of students that are actually in that category is pretty small, so a few students can make a large difference in that number. One-year retention, this is actually showing by first-generation students. You're going to see if they're not first-generation, they're in this column. So for fall of 2016, students returning for fall of 2017 was at 72.3% of students who are not first-generation are retained. And then we have this number, if they are first-generation student, they were only retained at 56%. Another number that's probably a little bit alarming to some is Pell eligibility status. Student is Pell eligible. We are only retaining them at 58.1% first year to second year. So what are we doing for all these students? Within our office, we have something called the Best Expectation Program. This is for students who are on academic probation. We set it up like a class. They're required to attend 12 sessions throughout the semester. We work on self-defeating behaviors. And I'll show you some data on that in a little bit. In spring of 2016, when I officially took over as the director in our office, we started an academic warning workshop. Prior to that time, we were just having it on students' transcripts that they're on academic warning, but not explaining what that meant. So we're now meeting with the students at the beginning of the semester. That's roughly around 1,000 students every semester we're trying to meet with to tell them resources we offer, what it means to be on academic warning. It's just kind of a warning period, and we want to make sure we can bring them back up. We've expanded our tutoring services on campus. We actually are now utilizing the 24-hour study space below our office, thanks to our partnership with Student Affairs and giving us that space. We do peer-assisted study sessions. Those are like small recitations that we hold in the evening. We've also run out of room because those have been quite popular for our high enrollment, high fail rate classes. So we've taken over additional space in DSU for those. And academic workshops, we're holding those in the evening. Exploratory programs, students who haven't declared, we know those are not held or retained at as high of a rate unless they declare pretty early a major at WKU. Taking aim is we send out emails to every student as soon as priority registration is done if they have not enrolled for the next semester. And then after multiple emails, we start into phone campaigns to ask what's going on, how can we help you and assist you to come back the next semester. We do extended advising hours, staying open into the evenings, which has resulted in a lot of students coming back. And then we also work with our students that are on academic probation, telling them about our repeat policy, instructing them on courses they might want to retake, and we're reaching out to about 700 students each semester at the end of that to work with them. I'm going to skip that one and just show this as a different way. So our Best Expectations program, since we've redone everything with that and turned it into more of a course and did it at a cost savings, over the last 3 years, we've actually seen less students being dismissed. So it is working. So it is not an academic issue. We are addressing that as a university. Same with our number of students that remain on academic warning. So we have decreased it by 16%. So that is a good thing. Another program we have is the fifth week check-in. After the first 5 weeks, we ask all of our instructors and faculty and staff, our faculty to report on their students. In fall of 16, we expanded that to include sophomores. So we are reporting on roughly 6,791 students. And then you see these marks. A mark is either excessive absence or a failing grade. It goes through, there's additional data there, but for the sake of time, I'll just do one. We have about 114 people that did follow up. That number needs to change. We still have a lot of students we're trying to make contacts with. So we successfully met and made contact with 2,700 students, but as you can see, we are reporting on 6,800 students. So we have a gap of follow-up that we need to do there. All of those are personal contacts, so that's all we're tracking. It's not to say other contacts haven't been made. It might just not be put into our tracking system. So you hear me saying that the stuff we're doing is helping with academics. So why did you see that decrease in the retention rate? goes back to what Sharon and you heard in the financial piece earlier. This shows students who had a term balance, so right when we were coming up to priority registration. So if you have above a 3.0 and you did have that previous hold, you were retained. Let's see. Oh, if you didn't have it, let me get this right. No balance, not retained at 18. Retained if you didn't have it at 81. It gets a little more alarming by how many we're not retaining. So if it didn't have it, we have some movers down there. So for the sake of time, we'll continue on. So what are we doing in the future? We're looking to review and eliminate registration holds. We've seen there's a ton of registration holds at the university, multiple offices having multiple holds. So we're working through that. We're working across campus with living learning communities. With registration, we're trying to change the way we do registration at orientation to make sure students are getting a fair distribution of classes and those classes for them to be successful. We're doing more advisor training to make sure students are getting correct information and put into the correct courses. We have a new report that was created. We're looking at students who had a 25% drop in GPA. And from this semester, and that's from semester before, so if your semester to semester GPA dropped by 25%, we want to follow up with you. That's a list of 1,600 students that we're trying to make contact with this spring. We're moving our office to more of a student success center and trying to make sure we help the student holistically. And then there's expansion of financial literacy to help with that earlier slide.
I actually would like you to go back to that All right. slide, if possible, because I think this is, if there's a thread that's running through all the things you've seen today, it's this one. Would you talk about, go in detail into each of those cells, please? But this is the message.
So I think this is the bigger thing you're seeing here. If you have above a 3.0 and you have that hold, there's not necessarily that big of an issue. It's 3.45% of not retained. If you have less than a, am I reading that right, Sherry?
Yes, less than 3.0 and 76.4.
76 is the one we're worried about. So have term balance, yes, they're not retained. So that is the part that is very disturbing.
Well, explain what a hold is. I think there's a...
They have a previous balance. Any money you owe to the university, at this point we were doing it. If you owe us a dollar, that hold was on there. We worked with some of those lower balances, but if you have fees owed to the university or any money owed to the university, you have a hold put on your account prior to priority registration. So less than a 3.0, we were not retaining them.
And this is after we did some interventions with the limits of the amount that the students owed. We worked with the finance and administration. We looked at students who had a balance of $500 and below. We worked with them. We got them in. We released the hold. They didn't have any other outstanding registration barriers, and we registered them for classes. The other thing that we're noticing here, and institutional research is going to take another look at that, is the first gen piece overlapped onto this academic preparation as well as the retention numbers. It's a double whammy. If you're a first gen, slightly underprepared, not taking advantage of all of the things that we have, they're less likely to be retained. So ISAC, you're going to hear from later, one of our arrows to hit that target. The other are the other programming pieces that academic advising and retention are doing, in conjunction with financial aid, in conjunction with the bursar's office. So we are focused on that like a laser, because we know that first barrier, there's information that's been provided by the Educational Advisory Board that shows that even submitting your FAFSA late, having a registration hold, even if it's easily remedied, it's a barrier that students who are first gen don't get over. They don't know how to adjust and how to access resources. Sorry.
Mr. President, Regent Ridley, I want to state this as clearly as possible. Any student that we're admitting, we're making a commitment to them that we believe they have the capacity, both the financial and academic capacity, to be successful and graduate. And what this points out is if they're not
ready or they're unable, we either have to make the commitment to get them financially able, we're able to pass their courses, or we help them get to a place that's less expensive, or it's going to help them get academically ready. Because those, that 76%, those 241 students, some portion of them, shame on us for admitting them.
That's right. I agree. And once again, to your point, it's not about how many we enroll. It's not just about the gross number. Thank you for that. That's very important, very much.
I'm not part of this committee, but I would welcome the opportunity for us to have this brought back and have discussion. There's a number of slides and a number of questions, and I just know where to place now. I'd welcome them coming by.
I think we could even talk about what's going on with the Living Learning Community, part of a business school that has some unique things going on as part of this retention effort with the Living Learning Communities. And so it deserves really its own presentation without trying to digest anything else before or after.
There is a good feeling, though, about this presentation when we've got the leadership that are recognizing it in advance.
This is great.
Then translating it back to us is very good. And I don't want us to get all lost in the how the watch is made, but how what time it is, and we're recognizing the timing. And thank you, Mr. President, for doing that and having the leadership to back you up. Thank you so much. It's very important.
So you all will be back.
And we'll do that. And Mr. Chairman, that's my short message.
That's my short message. All right, I'm going to suggest that we take 15 minutes to get plates and clear our heads just a bit. And then we'll come back and we'll swing it to the chairs.
This is what you're talking about. You know this about.